This is the AdNonTech Podcast, conversations about education, technology, and culture, with Dr. Doug Reed and Dr. Matt Stranick. Thank you for joining us.
My name is Dr. Doug Reed, and I am located in Abigwe, the traditional and unceded territory of the Mi'kmaq people.
My name is Dr. Matthew Stranick, and I am located in Manakwisk in St. John, New Brunswick, which is situated on the traditional and unceded territory of the Wolastoqiyik Maliseet people. Hello, everybody, hither and yon, and I think I've expressed this before, perhaps most especially yon, those of you on the yon side of the hither and yon equation. This is, as ever, the AdNonTech Podcast, although you might not know that as much recently, given the sort of three-week, the layperson would intend that as a hiatus. I would more characterize that as a backlog of work. However, I'm pleased to say, before bringing in the inestimable Dr. Doug Reed, is that I'm very pleased to say that over the next 3 hours, pending the release, the recording of this particular show, well, I don't know if look forward to is the right term, but Doug will be getting links to three finished episodes, wherein the onus is on him to listen to them all and say A-OK or... I don't think I'm throwing Dan under the bus by saying this. Dan just sort of is like, okay, it's ready, and I just push it out there. We have a higher isn't the right term. We have a different process for this show. So, as ever, we're just sort of making it up on the cuff, but you got a friggin' trifecta of the ENT coming out today, being Mother's Day. So, make of that what you will. Anyway, how are you doing, Mr. Doug, Dr. Doug?
I'm good. I'm good, man. I'm feeling way better than this time last week.
Right. As you'll soon come to appreciate, those of you who are on this educational journey with us, the four or five of you who seem to regularly check out these recordings every time, give or take, Doug was under the weather the last recording. Friends, but it's certainly good to know that you're feeling better, sir.
Thanks, because it was kind of self-inflicted. It was after my car accident. There was stuff I couldn't do in my yard, and then I tried to do it anyway and paid for that. So I'm learning how to be smarter, not just work harder.
Right. Well, the joys and affordances of spending more years on the planet, right? You get crafty. That's what I think. It's like I may be getting more intrepid, but I'm getting craftier by the month, I swear. Work harder, not smarter, all you aspiring educators or whomever you may be out there. Anywho, that brings us nicely to my opening gambit, as ever. What are we talking about today, Doug? Because that's kind of important and perhaps even more interesting. Why?
We're talking about creativity in EdTech. And the reason, this was never on my radar. This was never anywhere. Like, I have these lists of, hey, let's talk about this, let's talk about that. And it was something you said last week. You did. But it wasn't in a recording. It was in our communications.
In that case, I fully deny responsibility, and I will say AI was responsible for any screenshots you might produce. So there. But do go on.
No, you made a comment. I know how busy you are right now, right?
I've been known to make comments. Do you know that people have commented the fact that I make comments like throughout my life? I've heard this like, geez, did you really have to say that? Or geez, did you really have to say that in such a way or in such volume? Like, so that the upstairs neighbor can hear you? Like, yeah, apparently, since I was a child, if you can imagine, folks. Anyway, do go on.
No, the conversation we had was about getting the episodes finished and uploaded and all that stuff. And you talked about creative outlets. Right. And I realized that this had been such a creative outlet that we'd alluded to and we'd kind of talked about a little bit, but we never focused on the whole concept of creativity in ed tech. And that's what we're doing. But I never thought about it that way before. And I thought, okay, let's dig into this. Let's see what we have to say. Because I think we're both creative in our own ways. There's some ways I'm very rigid and stiff, but there's other ways I'm creative. So I'm good with that.
I think rigidity and stiffness are an intrinsic part of any creativity thing. I mean, I'll just be straight with you. I mean, I've sort of, since I was a kid, you know, envisioned myself very forcefully and, you know, to myself and other people as, you know, like I'm a writer. I'm going to write comic books when I'm a kid. I'm going to friggin', you know, try visual arts. I'm going to try and do that pretty badly. I'm going to try, you know, music through the band at school and do that pretty badly. And, you know, I'm going to do a lot of bad writing throughout my life. And it's all just, you know, part of a function of just like, I can't imagine life without, you know, just having something that I'm hacking away at, you know, whether it's considered publishable or consumable or not. Some of those outputs do go on to have like a public sort of aspect to them, which is friggin' awesome. And so to me, I just sort of look at this. I looked at this whole endeavor from the very get-go as something where it's like, okay, I can sort of get artistic fulfillment of a variety out of this. I can get professional sort of traction in a way. And it definitely fires on all cylinders for me, things that are cool, right? The media production piece, the writing piece, the public presentation, the educational notion of open educational resources and everything else. It's sort of a culmination of things that I've come to really dig and enjoy over a pretty long career at this point. So, again, not to kind of override your whole opening gambit, but I mean, you're just talking about it like, we should be sort of addressing it as such. And I'm like, well, yeah, man. And it's just, it's been part of the ether of this whole project. Yes. Since the idea of it became a thing. So anyway, dude, sorry to sort of tirade at the very beginning there. But
No, it's not the tirade. It's, I see it as a blind spot.
Okay.
Because when we, like, I love history. My first degree was in history. And we look back and there's stuff that nobody wrote down. Because of course everybody knows that. And now, because of what technology can do and because of where society is, people are doing a whole lot more of that. I honestly don't care what certain individuals eat every day at every meal, and I don't think it needs to be shared, but hey, that's their thing, good for them.
Question, totally off the topic, but when you're sort of talking about like maybe over-documenting, God help us all. That's a trip that I've been on for a while, oversharing, as it were. Again, I sort of see it as a function of the creative tangent that I kind of am on and have been on for the past little while, since I discovered Instagram, more or less. But more to the point, what happened to all the dog walk videos, man? Are you still doing them on a, like, you used to do them like on a kind of a daily basis? Is that something you're still kind of finding time for? Or I'm just saying they were kind of a highlight of the Instagram feed.
I'm doing them three or four times a week, but I'm not doing them every day.
Three or four times a week. Dang, I'm going to have to go and purposefully look at your feed then, because the algorithm certainly has been deficient in that regard. So what the frig is up with that, Zuck? Okay. Good to know. Thank you. Please proceed.
There's 770 dog videos right now, I think.
Man.
So, yeah, for the people that don't know me personally, I walk my dogs every day, and I take a little 8-second to 30-second video of them being dogs, and it just makes me feel better.
In the glorious environs of semi-rural PEI, it looks like, right? Semi-rural PEI.
That's fair.
Glorious, what it is. Cinematography off the friggin' map. You can't beat the friggin' location, the locale, the predictable yet completely various narrative of each time. You know there's going to be a dog. You know it's going to start. You know it's going to end. You know there's going to be some kind of awesome PEI scenery slash weather to be had. And I don't know, man. It's a predictability and reliability and utterly unique each time it shows up, which is certainly values that we aspire for relative to the whole ENT format. Much as I'm going to be doing sort of an output of stunt production this afternoon by committing 3 whole hours to getting out 3 whole episodes, which are in various stages of completion and or non-completion, I just really am a strong proponent of a minimalism when it comes to process, simply because, like, why go for something more complicated than you need to under any given circumstances? It seems to me that that's just a recipe for complexity, misunderstanding, or failure. So to that end, I have been really spurred on by the passing of a really significant musical figure, at least for people who follow music, like underground music, I should say, Steve Albini. He's been associated with like numerous bands, and he's really more known as a producer. And he keeled over as a heart attack. It was officially released by the studio that he owns back a few days ago. And so I'm not going to dissemble on that now because this is really the venue for it. But it's certainly going to inform the overall completion of these 3 episodes vis-a-vis media and notes. The AI background here is not AI, actually. This is a GIF from the seminal friggin' rock record In Utero that he produced, Nirvana, you know, their final studio album. And I just feel like it wouldn't be at all what it is without Albini having been there to record it. So rest in power, Steve Albini. These next 3 episodes are sort of informed from a production sensibility to pay tribute to a very creative individual. He produced something like 2,000 records. And if you name 20 of them, you go, really, really, you know, he did that. And it'd be like, yeah, he basically changed the course of popular music, you know, behind the scenes in such a way that, you know. So anyway, again, dissembling here, dude. Shall we speak to Sampath 1981? Is that a good idea now?
Yeah, we can certainly do that.
Sure.
I just want to make one comment about my dog videos.
Awesome.
That's creative in a way that I didn't pay attention to.
Okay.
I do have the short little thing, and yes, it's going to be my dogs, and they're going to be doing whatever, and it's going to be nature. So I have those settings, and then it's like, how do I make it fresh and new each time?
Yeah.
And sometimes I do a good job, and sometimes I don't, and it's all discovered stuff. And in education, how often are we discovering? It's how are we doing today? Oh, so-and-so is not here, or so-and-so was with their other parent this weekend, or
right.
It's okay. It's rolling with whatever we've got. What do we have to deal with? It's like when you were a kid and the teacher said, you got to draw a picture, and the box of crayons went down the aisle and everybody grabbed 2 crayons. It's like, what crayons are left? Okay. That's what I'm doing. this is what I have to work with. So this is what I'm doing.
There are various high-paid corporate seminars on exactly this stuff. So, P.S., 506consulting.ca, you various moneyed corporate interests who wish to have the Dr. Doug and Matt show live in your or hybrid or remote in your setting for all your corporate executives. reasonable rates on half day, full day, and weekly seminars. There, I just put us in business, pal. High paid corporate interests should be paying us for this stuff. I sincerely believe.
I am more than happy to take that money.
No kidding. Friggin' A right. It sounds facetious, but it's not. Okay. Anyway,
so,
dudes.
So Sampath.
Yes.
1981. And Sampath wrote an article called Introduction to Educational Technology. And if people do a Google search now for creativity in education, it is basically about the students. It is basically how to give the students opportunities to be creative. That is, in the last 10 to 15 years, that's where the literature went, and that's where everybody followed. Mm-hmm. But this is 40-some years old now, and this was different. This was introducing technology into classrooms and giving the teachers the opportunity to be creative. And
awesome.
They talked about, here's some strategies and here's some challenges and how are you going to use the technology in your class, which is very different from where the literature went. And what I really enjoyed is they had a whole bunch of stuff on how to use the chalkboard in a comprehensive way.
That is
and
so
here's some
awesome.
Hints and tips and tricks for the
That's
chalkboard.
So awesome. I love that. That's
yeah,
rad.
So it was nice to go back to see how often do I look and find articles that are at the origin of the trend, of whatever the trend happened to be.
No it's kidding.
Like, this is like a seminal piece. I've never read, here's tips on using the chalkboard, because now it's, here's how to use social media. Well, AI. Here's how to use AI. And then it was social media. Then it was the internet. Then it was computers. Then it was movies. Then it was radio. Then it was chalk and slate or paper or whatever these things are. But to find the chalkboard one just made me feel good, because we were at an age where, okay, the teacher's the teacher. They're doing what they're doing. Right? It's okay. I'm listening. I'm doing that SRA reading book or whatever, that reading series. Do all the blue ones, now go on to the yellow, then go on to the browns or whatever that type of pedagogy is. So do you have any chalkboard tips or tricks? Have you ever used a chalkboard, or are you whiteboard?
Well, okay, so again, that's awesome. What I was thinking of while you were sort of describing that is that if any corporate interests and or publishing firms were to give us, say, a certain development budget for media beyond the immediate sort of WordPress format, it would be very interesting, like, and gratifying for me if we could sort of release a VHS tape of an episode of this show, or like a cassette only version, or like, you know, Betamax or friggin' 8-track, and just do like a total release it on as many redundant and or analog and or non-digital formats as we can, including perhaps, you know, like a slate, right? Have a slate etching with, you know, like take a QR code and like manually etch that into like a litho print or something. And I mean, literally just to be as esoteric as we possibly can. And to me, that would just be beyond gratifying, just to sort of be able to participate in that rendering process, as opposed to simply, you know, the usual PowerPoint, Camtasia, image file, audio file, WordPress, whatever, right? Like, I mean, which is all well and good. That stuff is essential. But I don't know. I believe strongly that creativity is inspired by limits of function, limits of format. Nothing helps a project along like a very clear, tangible deadline, for example. So in the absence of a deadline explicitly, then, yeah, maybe you're going to get some drift on the project. This is now where I really fully dissemble into ways that aren't necessarily helpful. So you put me on a very path of thinking about what the various educational media outputs even are. And I think it's cool to imagine an alternate realm where, say, the internet didn't take off as much as it did. Say we're all doing radio broadcasts instead of, like, you know, online courses or whatever. Or, like, if education television just became a thing and we're, you know, as opposed to the internet, mind you. Steampunk, except the EdTech version of it, I suppose. Imagining alternate
features. Like that.
Right? Educational steampunk. Anyway, dude, I dissemble as always. What else can we say about Sampath, or shall we be moving on to the next reference?
Before we go back to Sampath, you demonstrated such a bias when you listed 4-tracks, 8-tracks, cassettes.
Yep.
You didn't include CDs, and for some reason you didn't include LPs.
Well, I'll tell you, my dude, I actually, in my very early time at CRU, when I still maybe had some latitude before the drain got pulled on my thing there, when I still was sort of had some latitude, I did a session which was like on educational vinyl, and I like brought in a record player, and I was like making a metaphor connection, and it friggin' went over like a lead balloon in that seminar. And at that point, I'm like, maybe having formats appropriate to audience expectation is what I should be gearing myself in for here. Again, my concept of that varied very significantly, as it turned out, from the rest of the team. Again, I regret none of it. I would probably do all of it again the same way, but I definitely value the various bumps on the way to the current path of creativity. Wherein we get to talk about this stuff through this podcast.
Can we do that? Like, you and I, can we do, like, an LP, that very PD session you talked about? Could we do that as an episode?
We could totally do that. We could actually do, like, a digital, you know, just a regular podcast episode, but then, you know, place the audio on a vinyl, right? That would take, like, resources, but, you know, I could put that as a business write-off for 506 Consulting. Good Lord, I actually had income that I had to report, like $500 got submitted to the government by a certain higher education thing. And I'm like, oh, okay, I actually have to account for this as business now. So in terms of a business expenditure, an episode, the vinyl episode. When we get to episode 100, I think that would be like episode 100. We're putting that on vinyl, and then the B side of the vinyl can be like episode 1, you know, as a like or whatever, or educational noises, right? Anyway, dude, it's so easy to go down rabbit holes with this stuff.
Like, well, that's my thought was, we could do a greatest hits. I at one point I was going through and I'm like, okay, I like that 2 minutes from that episode. I want to record that someplace. I like that 3 minutes, or I like that little interchange here. And then put that on vinyl and then get it gold so that I can frame it and put it on the wall above my record player. So if I ever want to listen to it, I could take it off, and because I have three record players.
I'll tell you, at one point, Wu-Tang Clan, the legendary rap group, went so far as to do a, like, they only did one physical media of a recording, and it was bought anonymously by the Pharma Bro douche, this guy who jacked prices for a very short period of time on by buying up patents for, like, life-saving drugs, you know, for people, like, with diabetes, AIDS drugs, and things like that. And then just lifting the prices significantly. Dude ended up going to jail for being a complete, you know, fraud and douchebag. But he ended up being like the guy who successfully procured this one-of-a-kind recording from the Wu-Tang. So it's sort of like when you overinvest in any format, the consequences are no longer yours to own necessarily, right? When you put it out for public consumption in whatever way. So, I mean, I'm in favor of vinyl, as I think people may know. and I think I've made that relatively clear over the past while. So having this, you know, thing that we do, manifesting on that physical thing, that would almost even be like, that'd be worth a Patreon subscription. That'd just be like, do you want to pay up $5 in advance to get this thing and then sort of underwrite the costs? Or, as I say, the various corporate moneyed interests and publishing firms may want to contribute to such an endeavor. Please be sure to go to 506consulting.ca. Good Lord, Doug, I'm just so full of tangents. Can we please sort of
let's go to Rizzo 2001.
Yeah, man.
It's Rizzo 2001, Creativity, A New Era in EdTech. And what this is this is still in the mode of the educator. We haven't started to focus on the student a whole lot yet with where the literature was going. So 20-some years ago, they talk about creativity as a product. And they're saying not enough attention's paid to creativity. And that's definitely changed. That has been addressed in the last 20-some years. But they talk about discovery, innovation, invention, and literally what we just did with our little brainstorm about maybe do an LP episode is exactly that, right? Like we're taking ideas, we're bouncing them off each other, and it's a safe space. It's not a, oh, no, that sucks, don't do that, because it's, no, well, maybe this, maybe that. And what I like with what we do is we don't judge ourselves based on our worst ideas. We judge ourselves based on our best ideas. that gives more room for freedom and more opportunity to figure out how something works. It's the fast enlightenment. How do we do this? How do we do that? Is it problem solving? Is it topics in an article? Is it a plan for how we're going to do some research? Is it literature, fine arts, a new theory, new techniques, new methods, whatever? And Rizzo covers that really nicely. And I cannot pronounce the name of the publisher. It is very long. It's in a different language.
Université Egitum Facultesse. I know I'm not doing that umlaut justice.
Yeah.
Université Egitum. Good Lord.
Yes. I don't know. My pronunciations are great at the best of times, I feel. And so the G with like that little U over top of it, whatever that accent is, I have no idea how to pronounce that. That's outside the scope of my experience.
I feel that perhaps some of these, you know, Baltic or, you know, East European languages, which that sort of resembles, have more like in common with like Cyrillic, you know, yep. And kind of like older, you know, like kind of Southern European non-Roman characters that ultimately later got transliterated into Roman characters, similar to how, you know, the Korean, except the Koreans did it the opposite way. They started with, you know, fundamentally a Chinese language and a fundamentally Chinese grammar, but then in a very short time transliterated that into their own language based on the sounds of the language. So I sort of look at that and I go, it probably originated in another alphabet completely prior to what we're seeing there. So anyways, my dude.
So Rizzo is more focused in this article on research, I believe, because They talk about how not enough attention is paid in ed tech. And then if you're describing your doctoral research, it is discovery, it's innovation, and it's invention. And that is awesome. I don't know how that can happen on a regular basis in a classroom if you're the educator in charge, because you have classroom management, you have marketing, you have all these other things. But as a researcher, you can be much more focused on discovery, innovation, invention.
Totally.
So they get to focus in a way that there's a lot of creativity in a classroom, but holy moly, it's very different. It's how do I get through? How do I make it to lunch? How do I make sure the students have co-created the rubric with me to make that work? And
okay. Napoleon Bonaparte said, an army marches on its stomach. Okay? So if you have the conditions met for logistical and administrative support that are reliable, functional and take the onus off the educator, then those are the situations where you're going to have the most amount of, if you're measuring success by engagement with students directly without shit getting in between, sorry to say, then that means you have reliable facility support, reliable curriculum that you can sort of, you know, bounce off of as subject matter, and reliable media and administrative support. So that requires a lot of planning and a lot of really great people around the educator, as it were. It takes a team to educate a child, I would argue, maybe more than a village in contemporary society. And people who just kind of slough it off like, oh, yeah, here's just one more thing that they're expected to do when they get summers off. Like, there's where you go with your summers off. Right? Anyway, unpaid labor in education. Let's do an episode about that sometime.
So what you just twigged for me is it takes a team, right? The infrastructure's got to be in place.
Exactly.
You can't skip 10 steps in creativity. I was on a research defense. I was one of the panel members doing that. You know, when you pick up the phone again, or the person walks back in the room and it's like, congratulations, doctor, that moment. I got to stay in the room. I already had the doctor, and I got to stay in the room and be the person to say that. And this thesis was so good. And I read through it, and I knew how good it was. But the title was Peering Over the Shoulders of Giants. Because in computer labs, right, that's what you're doing, right?
Right.
The students are working at a computer or whatever, and you're looking over the shoulder to help them. And it was such a great turn of phrase.
That is. And I like that.
And it was just so nice. And I was so jealous that I didn't fight more for my thesis title. I should have fought harder for the one I wanted when I did my thesis. But my supervisor was like, no. Right? Use that later when you're writing articles. Don't use that here. Blah, blah, blah. It was just a very different structure. Like, I wanted to do teaching across the ether. That's what I wanted the title of my thesis to be, because I was about online ed and all the structures and pedagogies and all that stuff that went with it. But I didn't. But that's the title that got away. I loved it.
I'll tell you, we're not going to name that this episode that, because I've already chosen the title for this episode. Yeah. But one of the, you got to actually bracket that as a title, something for us to use in episode. So teaching across the ether, man, as a friggin' reformed English teacher and lifelong literature file, bibliophile, whatever, I condone and appreciate that title, my dude. That's good.
Thanks. And part of creativity is taking that chance and saying, no, this is the thing I want to do, right? I want to try to do whatever it is you want to try.
Yeah.
And there's going to be times where it's like, oh, that's too hard, or I don't want to get up, or, oh, no, I need another coffee, or whatever. The challenges are going to be there. How do you deal with the challenge? Because if you just roll over and say no, then, okay, you're not being creative. So are you being fulfilled? Are you doing your best?
I don't know, man. I see what you mean with that. But I'm also speaking personally as somebody who, since Friday night, I spent 30 hours in bed. I got up yesterday just for like 2 hours, like just to go out for lunch with my mom. Happy Mother's Day, Mom. You rock. I'm grateful you're alive, Colleen. And my mom and I, she's like if you just sort of imagine less of my bullshit kind of elements and sort of take the more pragmatic and literary and straight up funny, that's where a lot of my mom resides. So very great pleasure hanging out at her place for lunch yesterday. And my whole thing about being in St. John for the past year, one of the great benefits for me is just getting to hang out with my mom once or twice a week since I've been here. Wow. I mean, don't ever forget people to tell the people that you're close to that you care about them. That's something that's important for me from a personal standpoint, but also, I guess, if you're talking about keeping the conditions for creativity strong, I've come to appreciate letting people know around you that, you know, when they're making a contribution, that you should definitely let them know that they're making a contribution. So that's a function of getting older, but I think it speaks to the point of, you know, giving yourself the best chance to be creative means, for me, acknowledging the things that other people are contributing and trying to make that explicit as much as you can. So a bit more of a tangent there, my dude, but anyway.
I cannot disagree with a single word you just said there.
Especially my mom. You don't matter, but she's awesome. Anyway, go Colleen. Yeah, right, I'm out. Cool. So where are we now in the notes, my friend?
I want to go to an article that was interestingly cited.
Okay.
It's Mishra. It's a 2012 article called Rethinking Technology and Creativity in the 21st Century. And Crayons of the Future, but whatever. It was by Mishra, and then it was by Deep Play Research Group.
Nifty.
And I don't see that often. I see people's names. I don't see, research group, the chunk of people. It's like, list them. If there's a dozen of them, put a dozen of them
on
the thing, right? If they've done enough.
Tech Trends is a professionally oriented publication. Tech Trends is awesome. I really appreciate what they do. They're the publication of the Association of Educational Technology something, AECT, I want to say, whatever. I can't get the acronym, but they are like a publication by the same group. And like a lot of the stuff they put out is really high quality. I get what you mean in terms of like break them all out. But I think probably the individuals in question work for a company and have signed agreements pertaining to their individual contributions to intellectual property or whatever. That's what I would think. But
yeah, I still don't like it.
Nor is anybody saying that you should. I'm just being
You're explaining very nicely.
I find it cool that you went to Tech Trends. I really enjoy that. That's sort of something. So
AACE, is that the American Association for Computing and Education?
Oh God, I'll just hold on. What you're going to say, and I'm going to just Google it. So,
okay. So in this article, they talk about myth one. They have a couple of myths. Myth one, technology tools we have today should drive how we conceptualize teaching and learning in the 21st century. That's horrific. I hate it. I hate it with the passion of a fiery son. It's not true.
Okay.
And because I believe how we conceptualize teaching and learning needs to be about the students first, not about the technology first. It's the wrong thing steering the boat there. So I'm glad they put that as myth one. Myth two is creativity can be taught in a contract neutral manner. And I love the fact that they focused on that as well, because I don't believe that's correct either. They don't. So I really like that they're agreeing with me. That makes me feel good.
Always a plus. I especially enjoy the things that I can find in the peer reviewed literature when they back up what I personally am interested in. Definitely.
Yeah, it's if you take a look at creativity, in my experience, because I have worked in places that were very positive, places that were very negative. I've worked in the physical environments where things had color and you could change the stuff on the walls and you could close the door. You lived in a cube farm. And I know when the creativity happened. It didn't
cube
happen.
Farms.
It didn't happen in the cube firm. I guarantee that. And everybody just had their headphones on because it was like, this is a failed experiment from the 1960s, but it was cheap. So let's do that and then blame people for them not being able to do whatever it is they're doing.
Can I interject?
I believe you have that ability. Yes. Go ahead, please.
Only to say that I spent 4.5 years working in a cube farm. 4.5 years, basically my early 20s to my late 20s, after I got my first degree prior to becoming an educator. And let me tell you, nothing makes you want to do something else more than doing something for sure that you know you don't want to do for however long. I'm not saying I'm any kind of cube farm martyr. I'm not saying, you know, this or that. I'm saying I consider myself lucky, you know, in as much as I kind of got through it and can refer back to it. Yeah, cube farms. Now, while you were speaking to that, I did locate on the interwebs here from Springer Link, the publisher. Springer Publishing, I guess, is sort of handling tech trends. It's listed here. It's got the AECT, right?
AECT. Oh, okay. I thought AACE. Sorry, go ahead.
AECT is a premier journal dedicated to fostering the exchange of current information in the fields of educational technology and instructional design. Contributes to the advancement of knowledge and practice in the field. It's got an impact factor of 2.5. I don't know what that means. It sounds probably pretty high. They turn manuscripts around within 83 days from picking up, from receiving it to when they adjudicate it, which is pretty strong. And, 558,000 and a half downloads as of 2023. So you've got a very broad and powerful source there, pal, in terms of, you know, a publication. Anyways, my dude, please continue.
Yeah, I don't always wander into the non-Westernized journals. I don't live in the ones from Kazakhstan and stuff all the time. I want to mix it up a little.
So. No, it's all good. It's all good. Relevance first, right? It's always motto. And one of the strengths of this show is definitely what you are bringing to the table by seeking out perspectives around besides, you know, North American / UK first tier peer reviewed journals that are contributed to by a very select group of academics and a very select group of organizations and institutions, right? And when I was in the, when I was doing my doctoral work, one of the things that was cool working with Garrison, you know, one of these strong original authors for the Community of Inquiry framework, was simply that he himself in one of those meetings back in University of Calgary seminar room, 2012, 2013, whatever it was, one of those summers where he basically was like, yeah, I definitely seek publication intentionally outside of the sort of mainstream, whatever, academic publishing. And that's one of the things that's made it such a viable framework, because it's just been so widely and intentionally distributed and supported by academics from outside areas and practitioners, right? So outside as in non-Western, non, you know, top 5% of all publications and institutions, which is where most people seem to get 80% or better of their reference lists. Whew, tangents, we got them, man. Okay.
Yeah, we'll have to talk more about publishing and impacts and all that stuff, impact journals.
Because we're going after it, like, from a certain...
Yes.
I am. I make no claims as to what Doug will bring to the conversation, which is part of what makes this interesting, right?
This is what happens when we don't script it out beforehand. We're rolling.
We're scrapping it out beforehand. We're hugging it. And good Lord, Doug.
So going back to Mishra and whoever the Deep Play research group people are, I just had to say that again. One of the things, this is the first article that I shared that is more about the students. It is more about cross-pollinating ideas, breaking down barriers, divergent thinkers across interdisciplinary venues. Because sometimes we build these disciplinary venues and it drives me nuts. But one of the titles I would like to have, I would like to be a natural philosopher. Because 200, 300 years ago, that was a scientist, because the word scientist didn't exist. So people were natural philosophers. But I shared, there's a little table one, technological innovations for the first 12 years of the 20th century.
It's a very good table.
It blew my mind.
Yep.
because they, Mishra et al. Had a bunch of cool stuff. I liked a lot of what they said. They highlighted some things I really liked, but I love this table because of what is included. So for the listeners, they have year 1901, here's some innovations. 1902, here's some innovations. It goes right down to 1912, here's some innovations. And some of the highlights are 1905, theory of relativity, 1903, first flight.
1909, instant coffee. Can you imagine education of any variety without the influence of caffeine? Holy fucking crap. I mean, pardon my French, but good Lord.
I had 2 cups of coffee until I was 51. I wasn't a coffee person. And both times, I was a student. I had a paper due the next morning, and I powered through the paper because I did. So I finished the paper at like 6 a.m. I'm sure nobody else has an experience like that, just trying to get it done. Then I had to go to class at 8:30 or 9. So I would go in. I had a cup of coffee then, and bang, I was wired. But I survived class. Those are the only 2 cups of coffee I had. Now, it's different. I had coffee this morning in my very nice Clatta mug that my mother-in-law gave us.
Awesome. Shout out to Aaron's mom.
Yeah. So we have, like, in that 12 years, they've listed the radio, air conditioning, instant coffee, theory of relativity, first flight, and Lifesavers candy. I don't know how Lifesavers candy makes the cut as an innovation.
Only in as much as that was probably before Tic Tacs. That was probably before chewing gum became readily available at every convenience store or every grocery store checkout. This is before the rack next to the cash register, wherein these things, these tooth rotting, innovations became the norm. So if you're at your general store, you can say, oh, well, I'll take some of them Werther's candies. And then what else do we got? Oh, we got these newfangled Lifesavers. Why are they called Lifesavers? Because they're shaped like a raft. They got the hole in the middle, like a raft. Oh, well, I'll take a gross of them then.
I think it's Life Preservers, the round Life Preservers. Uh-oh. Not the raft, but what I loved about this is I read that one and said, how does this fit? And then I had to get creative. And then I realized I had put barriers up for what I valued as innovations.
Dang.
Which helps me take a look at my own blind spots and say, okay, what's going on? Okay, let's change that. Like 1906, cornflakes, cereal was invented. I just grew up assuming cereal was always there. But you have to go back and realize, oh, yeah, somebody put their noodle to this and figured out how to make this type of stuff. But it was looking at it in a more creative way.
Yes.
And that's part of the outlook that comes in so handy for us.
We plan to monetize this through a series of corporate money seminars. 506consulting at gmail.com. Thank you. Cool, man. We should come up with a table, except we should do it for like the last 20 years instead or whatever. Oh, yeah. We should like a contemporary variant of this for the same number of years, and it would be nowhere as cool. I can tell you, nowhere as cool. But, that could be a thing we do just for fun and or misery.
Yeah. Shits and giggles. Yeah.
Yes. So what about Hendrickson, Creary, Henderson, and Mishra, may I say?
So this is a 2021 article. It's about creativity and technology and teaching and learning. And what they did is they took a look at it. It's wonderful. It's a lit review. So it's the way I always cheat. It's find the lit review.
I love a lit review. Holy crap.
Oh, yeah. Oh,
a good lit review.
Time savers. Somebody's already done the work to help with the curation of what do I need to look at. These are some highlights. Yeah, lit reviews. If you're doing any sort of research, if you're thinking about a master's degree or a doctorate or whatever, find lit reviews. They'll save you so much time.
Totally.
Anyway, that's not what I was talking about with this article.
No, it's good. We shout out where credit is due. Valuable format, scholars and practitioners alike.
Mm-hmm. They highlight, so this is 2021. This is 3 years ago. They're saying research around ed tech and creativity still has not been really comprehensively researched. We still need to do this. There's a whole lot of assumptions being made. And especially in actual classroom contexts, it's, I don't want to hear about that study where it's a convenient study because you happen to be teaching a class of undergrads, so let's use them. It's like, that does not interest me.
We got them. We should get some results out of them. We got them in this pen. You know, these sheep-like people. Be ashamed to let their, you know, potential as research subjects go untapped. Good Lord. I mean, I respect anybody doing action research, but it's just like, yeah, you know, fish in a barrel. Okay. Are they going to be education students? Because that'd be even better, right? Like, so much of our professional literature. So it's like, you know, you look at the, like, a survey group or whatever, and like, students in an undergraduate teaching program. Like, oh, great. You know, another one, you know, like, instead of engineering students or health science or trades or some fucking, you know, like, it seems like, you know, one third or better of these studies is just like, yeah, let's just go with people who are, you know, studying to be professional educators and are like among the cream of the crop, you know, within that. Like, okay, good. Sorry, dude. Just, no. You know what I mean. Clearly, you know what I mean.
We are reading from the same book on that one. We are on the same page. It drives us both nuts. Hey, I've done it. I absolutely did it.
Yep.
But
me
I
too.
Cringed the entire time. And I
cringy.
Hate,
absolutely cringy.
I hate when students really don't have a choice. You have to be a research topic subject because your prof needs to get another publication out next year.
Right. Wouldn't you enjoy the opportunity? And maybe some of you, if you're really good at it, can be tapped for research assistants next year. No relation, but, you know, it wouldn't hurt.
God. Yeah, exactly.
You want a master supervisor for your next year's thing? Oh, well, guess you better be an anonymous participant in this project. Jesus. Oh. I had a conversation with my mom the other day. This is really off topic, dude, but it's just sort of like, if you gave me the same salary option, and like assuming a stress-free job outside of the job, if you had those two constant variables and you said one of them's in post-secondary, one of them's in the private sector or in an NGO, I would choose private sector or NGO in a frigging heartbeat over post-secondary. I'm not over post-secondary, but man, oh man. I just know now how much more transparent it can be and how much less ego-driven it can be. I think colleges are kind of a different vibe from universities. But anyway, my mom and I just, it was one of the things that cropped up in our conversation yesterday over lunch. So I don't know where that came from, my dude, but.
The last face-to-face conference I was at, I met somebody who was a current grad student to one of my supervisors.
Okay.
So I was their student many years ago. They're the current student, and we had such a nice chat, and wasn't it wonderful? And
awesome.
There was two other people there from that same institution, and one lady was just choked. She was like, I hate you both so much right now. And it's like, I don't know her from a hole in the ground. And I'm like, what are you talking about? She's like, you're telling all these wonderful stories about your supervisor. And the other two ladies were like, yeah, we're surviving the Velociraptor. Our supervisor is a vicious piece of work. And it's literally, they have a support group with the grad students to try to
survive
the Velociraptor.
That really sucks. I'm sorry to hear that. Me my too. Doctoral supervisors were awesome. I shout out to Dr. Michelle Jacobson and for sure.
That's mine. She was my master's one too.
Well, okay, she wasn't mine, but she was like, I'm thinking back on it now. She was like sort of in the mix as like a professor among our cohort because she has a strong ed tech background.
Yep.
And just, you know, her among everybody else on the team that I dealt with there, you know, she actually worked with my former colleague, Kathleen Bradshaw, rest in peace, Kathleen, who passed away a couple of years ago. And it's just really, if you have like a positive instance of that relationship at the doctoral level, or I suppose at the master's level, I didn't have a supervisor really during the master's period, but during the doctoral period, if you have like a strong, good, secure team around you on the faculty side, like how awesome is that? I feel bad for your colleagues who were articulating the negative experience, you know.
For me, the fact that they had a name for it, surviving the Velociraptor, and that was outside my experience, right? Because I had it. Sometimes that doesn't say I didn't struggle with them, because there was some stuff that always happens with timelines and expectations and the quality of my work and what I was expecting. Like all that stuff happens, right? That interpersonal stuff, and that's life, right? But amazing people, I had amazing people, and I had amazing experiences.
Yeah, so I think we both did. I think we're both fortunate in that regard, for sure. Based on what I've heard from your career and dribs and rabs, and based on what you've heard from mine. So, it's all this to say is for all the critiquing and pedantic scrutiny that we put on things, I just think that, you know, we're both products on this show have been very successful, right? I mean, we went through those programs ourselves. We were good enough at it to play at the next level. We were good enough at it to, you know, get jobs of some variety working in these areas that we're still sticking with. So, I mean, you know, for us to sort of criticize certain aspects of it, this is from a perspective of people who have and are considered successful at it, right? I don't think anybody gets any kind of benefit out of like false reassurances or saying things could be better than they are. That kind of goes against the critical bent that this show really is about. But at the same time, I mean, credit where credit's due. I mean, like I said, I name check Michelle there, but I mean, that's just to sort of spare, you know, speaking to other people. Michelle's there. She's like, you know, been in charge of the, you know, various aspects of the department. I mean, I don't stay in contact with my past supervisors, but just having come out of that experience, you know, in a supportive way has paved the grounds for a lot of, you know, what I'm contributing to this thing and like what you have expressed as well with your supervisors. Right. So, and groups, particularly, again, we both worked at through University of Calgary. And again, shout out to the Workland School for being as awesome as they were and are, really.
And that's wacky because it wasn't the Workland School when I was there.
Okay.
The Workland State of Pylemite to them later.
School, like when I was on the way out.
Oh,
right?
Yeah, for sure.
But still, yeah, man.
Anyway, I want to come back to Hendrickson et al. For a couple of seconds.
Sure.
Because with this lit review that they did, they finally spun the narrative. And it's about here's how creativity can be fueled by the affordances provided by digital technologies.
Awesome.
Not the technology runs the show, but it's more, here's how we can do it, right? It's look at the massive connectivity that can happen. Look at virtual environments. Look at all these new possibilities for learning.
Virtual environments, good Lord. I know what you mean, but yeah.
Yeah, that's a term that I don't particularly care for because I remember the old instances of that 15 years ago when they tried to put other definitions on it, but...
Well, when I think virtual environments, it's like what is it like the simulated, fully like, oh God, you know, full
Second
on
Life.
VR simulate. Yes, Second Life. When I think of virtual environments, I think of Second Life, and I thought, wow, for all the benefits of that, something that was so overhyped, something that just like emphasized from an educational standpoint, completely the inverse things about EdTech that I tend to value. But at the same time, it's like, if that's a starting point, then it's good because it can get you to places that are much more productive. Yeah, virtual. I mean, just, sorry, dude. Yeah. But you go on. Or is there more to speak to with this one, my friend?
No, it was just Henderson et al. I finally found the article that said, yeah, it's about the students and about their creativity. It's not about the technology. And this isn't just – what was nice is it wasn't just about the students with them. It was also, yeah, the educators have to be creative too. And here's the affordances that the educators get to take advantage of as well. So it was that nice mix. We've kind of come from just the educators – we got away from just the students, and it's like, hey, we're all in this together, so we all have to find benefit in this.
It's a community. It's a constructivist or constructionistic paradigm based on collaboration and the building of new knowledge vis-a-vis social processes through a, you could almost say, a community of inquiry of sorts. And that's one of the things that I love about COI is that you can even take stuff that's completely been written about and described outside of COI, but put it as a very – see what I'm doing here? I'm trying to make a Venn diagram with my fingers.
Nobody listening can see that.
Well, I'm hoping that one of the five people who watches the YouTube will appreciate that I just made a Venn diagram, a three-way Venn diagram with my hands in representation of the community inquiry model, which is so flexible and robust and easy to explain to anybody outside of the education sphere, certainly. You could go to a room of accountants, lawyers, bankers, engineers, early education practitioners, or mechanics in the shop at the, you know, facilities garage and explain it in 10 minutes. And so, again, do go on. You can extrapolate that over what you just described is what I was trying to get at there.
Yeah, you can. So that's it for the articles that I found. And if you go to oios.ca/ent, there's some images there for people that are just listening on their headphones.
Awesome.
Because I don't know how to spell analog trope, and I know there's a dash in there, so I...
okay. Well, I'll tell you what then. So first of all, thanks for the reminder to include the link to the website in the YouTube clip. That's one thing that is going to be coming out with these three episodes that are going to be streaming. And for those, who are going to check this out via the audio files, for all you audio files who are checking things out through the audio files, the audio files are mounted at analog. It's the Canadian spelling of analog, analogue-trope, TROPE, .ca/podcast. And that gets you where you need to go. Between the Canadian spelling of analog and between the hyphen, I realize that's a tall order, but still, you know. Cool beans, man. So you got a friggin' SpongeBob. Can I just jump right into the SpongeBob picture?
Absolutely.
Friggin' A. Love a SpongeBob picture.
So I'm too old for SpongeBob. So
I'm not. Raised my kids with SpongeBob, man. Like, literally.
That's it. I miss that part of society. Me, when I've had a creative day and used my imagination. And I realize how true that is. And so it's SpongeBob with a big rainbow going across his hand.
God damn right.
And it's just, anytime I get to use my imagination and be creative, I'm happier. I just am.
100%.
I like to do that. It feels like if you sat at a chair for 8 hours and you get up and you're all stiff, that's what it's like if you haven't used your imagination. If you've tried to be creative and do whatever, it works better. in my life.
I find, Doug, that some of the interests that you've expressed, such as your quote-unquote rudimentary or quote-unquote apprentice-like carpentry and wood arts, are very much an act of a creative endeavor, right? I mean, you might just go, well, this is just what I do. It's like, well, you know, instructional design is there, whether you recognize it or not, it's there. So it's sort of like, well, something's creative, whether you recognize it as being, you know, categorize it as creative or not. So I would just say, man, like, I don't know how you sort of envision yourself as being a creative individual, but certainly just between the varied interests and outputs completely removed from the educational enterprise that you've described to me in dribs and drabs over these past couple of years, have just really, I think this is one of the reasons that the show has as much kind of sticking power as it does, because we both kind of draw from our experiences in other areas. Like with me, whether it's like the independent music kind of gig or, you know, this and that, and you with your wood crafts and sail outings and this and that. It's just, I don't know, man. I think it's all kind of from the same cloth, you know?
I had an epiphany. I was too hard on myself.
I think so. Lot. Yeah.
Oh, I'm way better now. Like, I used to be really hard on myself.
Oh, okay.
And when I was almost done the PhD, when I realized, holy moly, I'm a world expert. Like, people are coming to me from around the world asking me questions. I have the newspaper, like the Sydney Morning Herald or whatever, calling me and asking me for stuff about
that is cool as hell.
What's going in Sunday. So okay. I had that. But when I really realized I was creative, yep. I was a teacher and I taught with my uncle and he's like, hey, can you come over this weekend? And I'm like, okay, sure. Right. Like, not a big deal. I love my uncle Pius. He's fantastic. He's so amazing.
Pius?
Yeah. Like, P-I-U-S.
As in like a pope, as in like a religious person, Pius?
Yes.
Okay. Just want to make sure.
He was
along at home.
My mom had 15 siblings.
Jesus.
That lived.
Okay, pardon me, but happy Mother's Day to your mom.
He was number 12.
Good
so
Lord.
I don't know if they were running out of names at that point, but whatever. Right? I love them all, so it's fine.
Good Lord.
I grew up.
I'm sure you mentioned this before, but like I have my sister, okay? And we were like plenty enough for each other. So I'm trying to imagine, like, and then there were 12 more of them. Like, kudos, man. Okay. Yeah. Things that I maybe knew but hadn't been articulated expressly in such manner in a while. Radical. Thank you, SpongeBob, for the opportunity to discourse in such manner.
Yeah. So what happened is I went over to his place and my aunt and uncle, we were sitting in the kitchen talking. And then my aunt asked me, hey, what do you think of, I'm trying to do this with the dishwasher, right? There was something going on with the front of the dishwasher, whatever yeah. It was. That was years ago, in the 90s sometime. I was like, how could we, and I thought about it, I was like, well, why don't we just do, and I fixed it. Whatever the issue was that needed to be addressed, I addressed it in a way they had no idea. I'm like, this might work. Have you thought about doing that? And it worked perfectly for what they wanted. So that was a win. And then my nice. Uncle's like, this is why I invited you, because you think so differently and you come at it in a different way. And I'm like, oh, he goes, yeah, you're really creative. And it's like, I was unaware of that.
I've been accused of being erratic. I've been accused of being unreliable. I've been accused of being simple-minded and an abject failure in so many areas. And yet to me, it's all sort of just indicative of, you got to shed a whole lot of things, you know, that you're not, or that you're not good at, you know, to find the sort of things that you are. And it's like sort of with the Pareto principle. I mean, it's like finding the 80% value that you can provide out of 20% of your effort or skill. It's finding that kind of sweet spot. And I mean, I make no apologies whatsoever for you know, the shit that was messy, or, I mean, I apologize for any personal discomfort that people experienced as a result of whatever. But I mean, at the end of the day, you know, if you're being true to yourself and you're making a sincere effort to put something forward that's going to be helpful to other people, then, I mean, whatever, it's a win, even if the outcome isn't like the desired outcome. So you brought in your 20% of your bag of tricks, but it saved 80% of their kind of problem, right? Mm-hmm. I love a good constructual friggin' format, dude. Pareto Principle, FTW.
Yeah, I had another time when a friend of mine said, are you free tomorrow? Can you come over? And she described the problem. Like, she was trying to take apart a piece of furniture and the bolt or nut or whatever, or the screw head had been stripped. So she couldn't get it out. And I'm like, seriously? And the conversation kind of rolled around that, oh yeah, they had spent, she had some people over and they'd spent a couple hours trying to get this done and couldn't get it done. It's like, yeah, okay, no big deal. Right? So I brought a toolbox with random stuff in it. And I said, where is it? Walk into the room and it takes me 30 seconds. And it's just, well, let's try this. Maybe this could work. Maybe. And it was 30 seconds and it was done. And I came back out of the room. She's like, oh, can you not get it to work? It's like, no, that's finished. And it was just, oh, you didn't think of approaching it that way? Like, how else would you approach it except in a creative manner? How would you have a go with trying to sort that out?
Their creativity lies in other areas. And again, I think as we're sort of starting to wind down where we're going, yeah, with the show, I totally believe that we could be doing a part two of this, because if you actually just look specifically at just even some of the literature and some of the stuff that's popular about creativity in general, like, I mean, I'm thinking about somebody like Malcolm Gladwell. Those books that he writes,
yeah,
sort of taking cases that are kind of interesting and then kind of drawing things out and kind of writing about them in a kind of accessible way. I feel like we could do a stand-up job of that if we were so contacted by any publishing and or corporate moneyed interests in seminar and or multimedia and or book formats. Thank you, SpongeBob.
Now, if we do a part two episode to this,
yep,
I will describe the other side of my creativity, specifically including how many ways how not to get a stuck-on oil filter out of the engine of a car that you bought for $500.
Oh, Lord.
So creativity doesn't always work well sometimes.
Sometimes creativity leads you straight to the bottom of a rabbit hole, and the rabbit hole is so deep that you end up fractured at the bottom. Yeah. Yeah, man. Okay, and we got a dude, I don't know, we got a Johnny Depp meme here. Is that like politically cool? I agree with it. Johnny Depp?
Yeah, I don't care. It's okay, meme where Johnny Depp is sitting with a little kid on a bench. I assume it's from some movie. I do not know what the movie is.
Sure.
And the little kid says, "What is creativity?" And the reply is, "That's the greatest rebellion in existence."
Decent.
So I really enjoyed that.
Yes.
And there's some other ones there too.
There are. These are good. You got we got our meme game here. We got, okay, we got what's that show? I want to say
Big it's, Bang Theory.
Right. Yes, we got the dude from the Big Bang.
Yes. None of you are being creative correctly. It's like, you don't get to decide what my creative is.
Correct.
Your creative and mine is very different.
Unless you're paying my salary, and in which case I will bend over backwards to reconcile the two. No guarantees.
but no guarantees. Exactly.
But no guarantees.
So there's a couple of more there for people if they want to go to the website.
Good beans. And so then the word of the podcast, perhaps not surprisingly, being?
Creative.
Y'all.
Creativity. Creativity, sorry, not creative. I got distracted by your finger guns.
To say nothing of the Gloctopus guns.
The Gloctopus elbow.
The Gloctopus is healing up nicely. Thank you for not asking. And you see how, like, when I flex my elbow at all, the galactopus tentacles dance, right? So, like, anytime, you know, you got to watch the galactopus because there's, like, 8 tentacles and each of them's lethal, right? Potentially. So, good Lord.
Okay, here's the question. I'm jumping to the question of the podcast.
Please do.
I'm back to that how question. How can educational technology be used to support creativity in learning environments?
Good Lord.
And I specifically chose that because it's not just students and it's not just educators. It's everybody in the environment.
Okay.
And how can technology help and support, not be in charge or limit or force a certain thing?
No, there's a whole lot of really sort of good inquiry and concepts, conceptual backing, informing that question.
I hope so.
And folks, sorry, I was just sort of scoping ahead to the phrase of the podcast, and I was, okay, fair enough. You go on.
Phrase of the podcast is 506consulting@gmail.com, because that got mentioned a few times, so I figured, why not? And I got distracted with other stuff, and I thought,
There we go. And I have now gone into the actual landing page to ensure that that was actually an accurate representation. And lo and behold, I use it so infrequently that I, in my, you know, interest of saying it a bunch of times, failed to say it correctly. So let me clarify now by saying 506, that is to say 506, consulting NB, meaning New Brunswick, which is where I'm located. If you're following along at home, 506consultingnb@gmail.com. And apparently this is a real business now because I actually had it reported by somebody other than me on a tax form that I had to account for. So I'm standing by that. And so are we. Cool, man.
It's good that I put that down as the phrase.
Right. We'd be guilty of misrepresenting our own propaganda within this thing, which would just be, I wouldn't want the day to go by with letting that stand, man.
Yeah, and this way we don't have to really go in and do a correction.
I don't even have to do so much as a Camtasia edit. Fantabulous. Fan-friggin-tabulous. This has been good. I've enjoyed this. We are going a bit long on the episode, but that's okay, considering the breadth of the topic and considering that it's Mother's Day and every other darnation thing it might be to you on a Sunday. Do we got anything else we want to throw out here, bud, before we close her down?
I just want to say I had a good time. I enjoyed it, and I hope people get something out of it and come back next time.
Yeah, totally. And I can assuredly say here that we have a three-peat of Ed Dantec coming at you this very afternoon. So going to him. And then, you know, from there outwards. Thanks a lot for following along, everybody. We appreciate it as always. And bye until next time.
Bye for now.